Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Peter Ames Carlin is a music writer and the best-selling author of Sonic Boom, The Impossible Rise of Warner Brothers Records, and Bruce, the biography of Bruce Springsteen. Peter's latest book is The Name of This Band is R.E.M., a biography. Peter writes lovingly about one of the great American rock bands of the late 1900s and how their own distinctive sound influenced alternative rock. And let's face it, rock and roll has been around so long that it is hard to come up with a new sound. But Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, Mike Mills, and Bill Berry pulled it off in a way that few other bands could.
They met each other in Athens, Georgia. Three out of the four of them were students at the University of Georgia in the late 70s and very early 80s. And Peter Buck, who had dropped out of Emory University in Atlanta, was working in the Wuxtry record store. Bill and Mike had gone to high school together in Macon, so they knew each other as teenagers and came to the UGA together. Michael met Peter at Wuxtry, and they just started talking about weird punk records and indie stuff that they loved, and they had so much in common, they started making music together. And a mutual friend of the four of them introduced Mike and Bill to Michael and Peter and suggested they would, you know, maybe hit it off musically, and they began to rehearse together. And 3-4 months later, they had enough material to play at the friend's birthday party.
I'd like to get your take on one of my favorite passages in your book. I'm just going to read it to you because it just really stuck with me. Quote, "And the whole point of art, at least the way it was taught, practiced, and admired in Athens, was to be only like yourself, to describe the world the way you saw it, felt it, and tasted it," unquote. Could you elaborate on how that applies to REM?
If we think back, you know, 40 years to the early 80s, sort of the overarching pop music influence was MTV and commercial radio. And there was this moment of real sort of aesthetic conformity that was coming because so much of the music was being channeled through corporate gatekeepers. And so bands like independent bands and these kind of punk or post-punk bands, particularly REM, were playing in opposition to that idea. And so as opposed to trying to channel some sort of popularly held notion of what rock and roll should be, what songs should sound like, they were determined just to be completely different in every conceivable way, shape, and form. I think the first line in the book, in the prologue, is even from the beginning, you would know them by their refusals. And there's this litany of all the things in the course of their career that were standard for other artists to do that they would have nothing to do with. But it was this idea of expressing something so deep within, you know, that became really their guiding impulse.
Mm-hmm. And as you've touched on, they had their own sound. And that, in my opinion, is like half, maybe three quarters of the battle to stand out when you're a new band is by having your own sound. And as you say, it was a new kind of post-punk alternative music that straddled obscurity and directness, dissent and delicacy, unapologetic and unashamed pure pop, which I think you nailed it with that description.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that was like part of the magic of that band, or a large part of the magic, was how diverse their influences were. Because all four members of the band, you know, not only came in with different influences and different types of music that they loved and sort of wanted to weave in, but, you know, they were all composers and they were all writers and central to the band's creative mission. And so weaving all of these influences together, I mean, when you think about Michael Stipe, I mean, that guy's, the things that he heard as a kid were like bubblegum stuff. You know, he loved the Monkees. He loved the Archies. He loved that kind of late 60s, early 70s pop stuff. But then the moment he began to hear punk music and glam music, and then especially Patti Smith, the more he became enamored of that kind of edgier sort of artistic sound, because he was also very involved in visual art and very interested in avant-garde art of any sort.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. And speaking of Michael Stipe, some critics had trouble making sense of his lyrics and the early videos that he created. What impact did that have on the band?
To the band, you know, that was, as they say, a feature, not a bug. You know, the idea at first, and some of this came from the fact that Michael wasn't necessarily confident about his lyric writing or his singing, you know, at an early age. They kind of made an aesthetic out of that by saying, well, the voice is just another instrument. And so we're not going to mix his singing above the sound of the instruments. They're going to weave them all together, and it's going to be the solid sort of sound, and you can make as much sense of it as you want to. And meanwhile, Michael's lyrics were very elliptical, you know, very sort of abstract in a sense, which had a beauty of its own because it left open so much room for interpretation. Even if you could hear what he was saying and make out the words, the next hurdle was trying to figure out exactly what he meant by that. You know, wolves lower, for instance.
Right.
Or gardening at night. You know, these obscure phrases. And some of them were, you know, weird old Southern colloquialisms. And some of them were just things that he made up in his own mind. But that was sort of part of the magic and the mystery of the band.
Yeah, very much so. And it certainly worked to their advantage because you have all these fans listening and closely, you know, being really close listeners to the lyrics and, hey, you know, and thinking about them. So that's an incredible accomplishment. One of R.E.M.'s most beautiful songs is Fall on Me, which was one of the singles from the Life's Rich Pageant album. What's your take on this song?
You're right. It's a very, very beautiful song. And in a way, you know, structurally, it really kind of expresses this kind of compositional thing they fell into of these kind of, you know, minor key verses that sort of grow into these kind of surging major key choruses. As a lyric, as a story, it's sort of vaguely about the fall of the environment, in a sense, and the idea that consumerism and, you know, environmental degradation are going to lead to, you know, the literal falling of the sky. And so they're also beginning to trace this kind of progressive political and social set of ideals that governed them as individuals that they were beginning to channel into the band.
Mm-hmm. Let's fast forward to 1990. R.E.M. is recording songs in various studios for their upcoming album, Out of Time. One of the songs is Half a World Away. What did you think of this song the first time you heard it?
Oh, well, that's a beautiful song.
This could be the saddest dusk you've ever seen. Turn to a miracle. I lie.
I mean, one of the things about Out of Time, which is amazing, is, and I think one of the reasons why it's such a successful album, both in commercial and artistic terms, when they started working on it, they didn't set out to make a record. They had just come off this exhausting year-long tour promoting Green in 1989, and they had played sports arenas all over the world. It was their first kind of major rock act tour, and it was exhausting and left them in Athens, and they're, you know, figuring that they were going to spend the next few months just trying to unwind and reload and just kind of heal themselves. And what they ended up doing was they just gravitated together to their sort of rehearsal space and just began to kind of throw out riffs and stuff and gradually built all these songs.
Mm-hmm. And it was around this time that Peter Buck was learning to play the mandolin, and this caught Michael Stipe's attention. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, you know, Peter wrote this incredible melodic groove on the mandolin, and he created that incredible, you know, melodic riff and chord set of chord changes.
That was just a dream. That was just a dream. That's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight, losing my religion.
What would happen would be the three instrumentalists, when they were writing songs, would sort of put together their ideas and create these grooves and these sets of chord changes. And Michael would listen to them. You know, he'd either come in and hear them play them as they were rehearsing and writing. And sometimes they would, you know, dub cassettes or whatever and hand them to them. And if a song really struck him in a way that he felt like he could write to it, then he would start working on a lyric and also a melody.
On March 1st, 1995, drummer Bill Berry collapsed on stage in Switzerland. What happened?
What happened was he had a brain aneurysm. So a vein in his brain burst, and it was incredibly painful, as you would imagine. And nobody knew what it was at first, and it took them a while to figure that out and get him to a hospital, because he was accustomed to having migraines, but this was a migraine on a whole other level than what he was used to. And they were in Lausanne, Switzerland at the time, which happily turned out to be the home of the center of modern brain surgery. And so they rushed into the hospital, and fortunately the doctors figured out what was going on and had developed a new strategy to heal those things and take what had up to that point been a very debilitating, often fatal illness and make it eminently curable.
Yeah. Bill contributed a lot to REM besides his very precise drumming. He wrote Everybody Hurts, Man on the Moon, and Perfect Circle, among others. How did Bill's departure affect the rest of the band?
Well, obviously it was jarring for them, I mean, not just losing their friend as, you know, a part of their collective and missing him as a person and his friendship, but also the fact that he was, again, you know, a key member, as they all were, to their creative chemistry. And one of the roles that he played that was super important was he was kind of the band's editor-in-chief. All the other members had their own impulses and their own sort of temptations. And his expertise was being able to help say, no, 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 like that goes on too long, or, you know, that's not working over there, and we need to cut this down and make it more direct. You know, his whole thing was, it's got to rock, you know, it's got to have a groove, it's got to work, you know. And so he was the one guy in the band who they all trusted when he said that the things that they were doing weren't working.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but I never expected Dan Rather to become a muse for REM. But that's what happened with their 1994 hit, What's the Frequency, Kenneth? What's your take on this song?
It's a fantastic song. I mean, it's a great crunchy rocker. It was the opening single for Monster, kind of the piece that kind of propelled them into the world tour that they did the next year.
What's the frequency, Kenneth?
And the lyric that Michael wrote for it is basically about just the sort of chaos and confusion of the then modern media. And the expression that he went back to as a way to kind of sum it up was, what's the frequency, Kenneth, which was the weird non sequitur that some crazy person screamed at when he attacked Dan Rather, who was then the CBS anchor for the CBS Evening News, on the streets of New York. And poor Dan got beaten up by this guy who was yelling this nonsensical thing at him. And it became a big news story in the mid-80s, as you would expect. And then 8 years later, you know, Michael sort of remembered it. The idea of someone screaming something that doesn't make sense at you and then beating you up is, I think to him, that was his emotional experience of watching the media. And so when they went to perform the song on the Letterman show, somehow they managed to get Dan Rather to come on stage and play percussion and at least attempt to sing background vocals with them.
The members of REM did not want to be interviewed for your book, and they're going to regret that. Well, you wait and see. Huh. But if you could have asked one member of the band one question, what would it be?
If I could have asked them any question, I mean, to me, obviously, you know, you want to hear as much as you can about the creation of the art, but really, you know, the question that I want answered in any book is to find out, like, how did it feel to be there? What was it like? Because we know what it sounds like, and we know what you've said about the making of the music or the, you know, the performance of it on stage. But like, what was your actual emotional experience of being in that position? One of the things that's most fascinating about REM is the fact that they were so grounded throughout it, almost alone among bands who got to be that big. They don't have those like big conflicts, you know, that kind of operatic backstory. They just seem like a bunch of well-adjusted, nice young men.
Peter Ames Carlin, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on the name of this band is REM, A Biography. It is one of the best music books I've ever read, and I look forward to your next book.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Peter Ames Carlin is the author of The Name of This Band is REM, A Biography. Find out more about Peter's book and REM at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Charlie Brooker, Kyle Chayka, and Peter Ames Carlin.
They have a lot of zany stuff on this program, don't you think?
Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
It was created for WPR by yours truly and Adam Friedrich.
I don't want to be rude, but I think you're mansplaining a bit.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Did this start at the top and work down, or start at the bottom and work up?
Our executive producer is Brad Colbert.
You know, do we really need them, or could we just do without?
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
You're much gloomier than I expected, because you're quite smiley.